Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Thank you so much for being here. We're going to get started promptly because we have to end promptly for a variety of reasons. I'm Hal Plotkin. I'm privileged to be the interlocutor for today's session of the DeReskill at University Project. The DeReskill at University Project is a collaboration between Sorbonne University, the University of Milan, the Free University of Catalonia, and the Budapest University of Technology and Science, of Technology and Economics, excuse me, in consortium with the European Digital Technology Development Services firms of Bellini Consulting and Alfheim Consulting. I'm very happy today to be able to present a conversation between three experts in the area of skills-based education for employability. Kathy Manis is the Vice President of Impact Partnerships at Jobs for the Future and a former treasured colleague during my years in the Obama administration. Peter Mirsky is the Head of Development and Studies and the Chief Information Officer at the Management Center at Innsbruck, also known as MCI. And my colleague Mitchell Peters is a lead on the micro-credentialing in European Higher Education Project and a postdoctoral researcher at the Open University of Catalonia. And Peter, if I can, Mitchell, if I can, let me begin with you. Perhaps you can introduce yourself a bit more thoroughly than that and describe for our fellow panelists and for the others joining us today, the DeReskill at University Project and why it is that you think you and your colleagues might benefit from some of the high-level advice and reactions that our distinguished colleagues, Peter Mirsky and Kathy Manis, can bring today.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for being here for this dialogue. As Hal mentioned, my name is Mitch Peters. I'm at the Open University of Catalonia. I have a research and development role. And I work in the lines of lifelong learning, online higher education, and employability through reskilling and upskilling. Our university has a mission for lifelong learning. So we have a non-traditional student profile, you would say, more from 25 to 55 years old. We have about 90,000 students at our university, many studying part-time while working full-time. And so workforce education and education for employability is a high priority for our university and our university's mission. I think competency-based education, skill-based education is sort of well established as something that is necessary today, moving away from maybe older models of learning based on rote memorization, exams, and repetition. In relation to the DeReskill project, as Hal mentioned, it's a project among a consortium. We have the core overview is developing virtual career guidance. So, you know, using a mobile application, a mock-up of a mobile app, we're trying to provide virtual career guidance based on competency-based guidance and training. We're linking it with the ESCO ecosystem, which is the European Skills, Qualifications, and Occupations database, which is trying to, you know, provide trying to basically link education and training and labor, which is, I think, a big challenge that we face in Europe and all around the world. I'm in the US today, and the same challenges are faced here. The disconnect between workforce education, workforce training, and higher education. One of the other core conceptual features of the DeReskill project is the development of a smart catalog linked with training offers, more personalized, flexible training offers. So using virtual career guidance, linking learners to courses which meet their needs in terms of the skill gaps they may have between where they are today and where they want to be in a targeted occupation. For example, the use cases we have in the DeReskill project involve data science and the field of chemistry. So if a learner is looking to become a data scientist, upskill or reskill, they need to have they need to have awareness about their own skill profile, where they are now, and the skill profile of a targeted occupation, be that data science or another area. And the mock-up of the software we're trying to design will provide the user with a skill gap, information about what they need to upskill or reskill toward, and offer them courses which will help close that skill gap. That's the basic overview of the DReskill project. It's something that has built on previous work. I think that's why Peter Mirsky is here. There's other projects at the European level that have focused on this: career guidance, virtual career guidance, upskilling, reskilling, trying to understand the skill profiles of users and the skill profiles of occupations and how to connect. And I think that the general mission of this is to empower learners to access employability. So I could talk more. Excellent. And more, but I want to open it up.
Yeah, let me stop you there for a second. Yeah. Let me turn quickly to Peter. Peter, first, could you do a more adequate job of introducing yourself? What I can tell our viewers is that, of course, you are widely recognized internationally for your substantial leadership and accomplishments in this field, and you're a treasured advisor to this project. And I'm wondering, as you hear Mitchell speak, as you think about the difficult problems that they're trying to solve, what would be the most important advice or items that you would like to highlight in order for them to be able to effectively achieve their goals, to actually make the kind of substantive difference in people's lives that's been at the center of your work? But perhaps, Peter, you could begin by a bit of a more adequate introduction of yourself and your work, and then perhaps provide some advice to Mitchell and his colleagues.
Well, thank you for giving me the floor, and also thank you so much for having me. Well, just in a nutshell, as said, my name is Peter. I'm actually here located in Innsbruck, Austria, and I'm a teacher and researcher in the field of digital transformation, and I'm running several research projects, and I did so also in the past, and I was also at the maintenance, part of the maintenance committee of ESCO. So I was in the team who was developing all those standards European-wide, and I also had research projects trying to find a perfect match between people who are job-seeking and job offers. So I'm very also research-related in that topic. Well, that is it. And advice is always to keep it very, very hard to give an advice. But I would love to add a perspective to confuse the panel a bit, because when we were developing the standards of ESCO, for example, we did not have so strong. We had, but not that strong. That strong and heavily used of artificial intelligence like ChatGPT. Actually, I'm in different panels thinking about what these kind of technology does to education, not only to university education, but also to the education of people who want to upskill for specific jobs, plus that the job profiles are being affected dramatically in different aspects. So I think this is a huge impact that does make changes necessary in designing curricula, and also in the fact that these formal learnings, which people sometimes needed to run their jobs, to be very effective in their job place, are now being replaced quite rapidly and dramatically. So I think this would be the next step also in order to design curricula or offers or matching offers, to have that in mind, that you can have a very nice dialogue. This was part of my research project. We actually developed a chatbot 5 years ago that nicely worked, But now it is available at the fingertips of everyone to say, well, I'm Peter. I did that before I went into our session today. Saying, okay, I'm just out of high school. What would you advise me? I'm interested in digital transformation, and I would love to study in Austria. And I had a very nice conversation with ChatGPT, offering me my own study program, which was very nice. but nevertheless, I think the dialogue, that is always the problem if you want to build a machine that optimizes a match. That this machine is always lacking information. And the dialogue is, I think, one of those keys to get a closer look to the needs of the potential employee and the employer to make that match better and better. And these technologies are out there, and I think we should embrace those technologies and try to integrate the idea. Well, that is my just opening.
Thank you, Peter. That is absolutely fascinating. And I think the role of AI, you know, I'm here in Silicon Valley talking to you from Palo Alto, and spent 25 years as a journalist here. And one of the most heart-wrenching things that I've often seen and encountered is when I would visit entrepreneurs who were just finished reading about how some new intervention had completely obsoleted something that they'd been working on and were planning to introduce the following week. The field is moving so incredibly quickly, and it presents enormous challenges for people who are trying to fill this gap skills-based education. Let me turn quickly now to our colleague, Kathy Manis in Washington, DC. Kathy's a key leader there at Jobs for the Future, which, as you may know, plays a very substantial role in conversations in Washington and nationally in trying to encourage progress and innovations to enable more people to achieve career mobility and upward mobility. And Kathy, when you look at these efforts underway in Europe, and you track similar kinds of efforts, and you establish collaborations and partnerships for Jobs for the Future, what would you observe are the current challenges that Mitchell and his colleagues need to overcome? And do you see any opportunities for collaborations with European leaders in this area of developing new applications and new methodologies for matching people with opportunities for upward mobilities that are skills-based and not the traditional four-year college path? Oh, and Kathy, if you could introduce yourself as well a bit more so people know a bit more about your background. Oh, and before you do that, let me just mention to those online, we would welcome your questions and comments. If you care to have any questions, put any questions to our panelists, please use the chat box and we will encourage our panelists to respond to you as they are able. Kathy, please.
Thank you, Kathy Manis, and it is a pleasure to be here, and I thank you very much, Hal, for giving me a lens to what's going on in Europe. Already the things, both the opportunities and the challenges that have been mentioned are things that we're wrestling with in the U.S., and so I think there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration, share learnings, and hopefully get beyond some of the barriers that we're going to need to do, because we're changing the paradigm. And I think what's most exciting about this work is it really can shift opportunity for large numbers of people at all levels of society. Jobs for the Future is a large and growing organization. We say that we work at the intersection of learning and work. And we are very committed to economic advancement for all. So a little bit different lens than you might have from some of the universities. We see the things that we're discussing today as real opportunities to level some playing grounds, to provide opportunities for people who might not have seen them before, to get away from the idea that everybody, and sorry if this is offensive, needs 4-year college degrees, because we're focused more on the skills and the ideas that have been already expressed today that people can continue to develop and upskill. And we are, looking at changing systems, and that doesn't always work well on, the first date. It takes a little bit of time so that people see that this idea of moving towards competency and skills-based training and education is an opportunity and not a threat. I work a lot and have in the past with community college system in the U.S., and a lot of the work that we're doing in relation to this skills work is done through the community colleges, because we find that they're flexible and able to adapt. But even they, we're changing the minds of faculties and structures that have been there for a long time. And I also work very closely with a number of companies that you see in your own backyards that are inspiring and challenging and confusing in some ways our current systems. Companies like IBM, Google, Verizon, Accenture. Sorry?
No, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. And they are, we work with them to show how the college systems and universities can integrate the programs that they've developed and the programs that they're making available widely, and often the programs that they offer for free, to integrate into the colleges and the current training. We also are working closely with groups like of human resource managers and talent acquisition people to show how what we call hidden talent, I don't know if that's a term you all use, can help, how we can give opportunities to the hidden talent, but also make employers more aware of people who have not had access or opportunity in the past. So love to talk about that and some of the other things that have been brought up. We pay a lot of attention to the technology and believe that that is the hope right now that can make it can drive a lot of this change.
And Kathy, just quickly, do I detect from the corporations, the major technology firms and others that you work with, that their interest in your work in some way reflects their own conviction that many of the job applicants that they're seeing, even those with the 4-year degrees, are not arriving with the kind of skills that make them useful as employees? Is that what brings them to your door?
Right. They can be much more focused, and they can be much more aligned with the opportunities that exist. And we can sort of redesign the career paths, because even when they arrive at the door, what's the next step? And how do we build that in from the beginning?
Very. So Peter and Mitchell, Kathy mentioned this word, and it's a word as I made myself more familiar with your work and your background, that I think is the unspoken word that I can read between the lines of both of your CVs, which is the word hope. I think in some way you are distinguished researchers in this field, but what's between the lines is the hope that technologies and developments in technology can be aligned and developed in ways that provide hope to people who otherwise might not see opportunities for themselves through to self-advance through training, education, and job placement. And I guess what I want to ask you, let me start with you, Peter, is the hope that has infused your work, that's clearly animated by the specific work that you and Mitchell and others are doing. Do you have reason to believe that there really is hope that we can make substantial progress in this area And what's the basis for that hope? And how would you know whether those hopes are whether your hopes are being realized?
Well, that's a great question, Al. Thank you for that one, making it very easy for me to answer. First of all, I'm quite sure that is true for me and Mitchell as well, that you read perfectly between the lines. If you dedicate your career to being a researcher in the field of education, for example, you're doing that for a reason. And the reason is manifold, but for sure, the idea is always to bring people to a higher level of education or a higher level of being able to come up with decisions, for example, or craft their careers, etc. I think the challenge is that, as far as I can see it for Europe and maybe also partly of the US, is that the educational system is always a very intransparent system for one who is just not educated, right? So you never know what is your personal outcome if you have your bachelor's degree or if you went to high school or not. You're just hoping that it will be all right, and you're hoping that your teachers and the environment and the organization treats you well, etc. So making an a system which is not transparent, intransparent system, transparent is something which machines can do. And therefore, I would say there is a lot of hope. One of the next steps which we see not only in the sector of education, but in the sector of business or finance, is that standards, global standards, are helping to make things more transparent, at least more transparent. Not directly better, but more transparent, so that you can compare offers and compare things with each other, which is the first step in order to make your own decision. And that also happened, for example, to ESCO, but that is the next level. And if you now create systems which are talking to you in a natural language, which you can ask, not only see a catalog of skills and competences, transversal competences. I stopped counting with our ESCO items. I think when I stopped counting, we had 16,875, which is quite an intransparent catalog for a non-expert. But creating systems that can talk to you and compare it for you, I think this is reason for hope, and it does make sense that you research and invest time in that. And making these things available at the fingertips of the end users in small items. Mitchell was sharing that he's on his way to a conference on microlearning, saying the larger educational path is, the more intransparent the path is for a guy who wants to be educated, like a 5-year program, a 3-year program. Going to in smaller items like micro-credentials also helps you to understand better, well, this is an interest for me. And maybe someone on a meter level helps me to connect some dots to say maybe this is a higher degree of any kind. So this is my hope. And I think that is something that helps people and young people, disabled people, any kind of groups which we see in our educational systems, to come up with better decisions and a clearer picture. This is my hope.
Yes, yes. Good. Mitchell, let me turn to you to do perhaps a deeper dive into that. You're an intriguing personality in this field, including because of the fact that you have your feet on both North America and Europe. As a matter of fact, you just happened to be in Boston today, as Peter referenced, for a conference. You've been working with the ESCO Skills and Competencies framework, as you're helping to co-lead the reskill project. Does that framework that Peter helped develop, the ESCO database, does that give you more reason for hope in terms of how technologically mediated opportunity systems can be developed and enhanced and continuously improved? Does it complicate matters? What's the What's the relationship between the ESCO framework and hope for progress in the field?
Well, let's first set the context. I think that the ESCO framework is part of a broad policy initiative by the European Union. It is a very good foundation. Does it have limitations? Yes. But is it a good starting point? Absolutely. And is it necessary? Absolutely. But does it represent the complexity of the labor market and the relationship between qualifications, credentials, and employment? There are some limitations there, but I think it's great. I mean, and they recognize that as well. I think it's an iterative project or an iterative database, which we're hoping to contribute as well. Our team from Sorbonne has been in communication with ESCO, and they welcome that. They welcome extending ESCO because there are nuances of skills. And skills, as Peter mentioned as well, skills are evolving. New skills are emerging. Old skills are disappearing. And so to be, and then obviously it's the ESCO system is part of a broader bureaucratic system of the European Commission. So it's difficult to move at the speed of a company like Google or, you know, but it's a great starting point. I think we need to recognize how we can extend it ourselves as researchers, what Sorbonne has been doing. But it's a great tool to empower. And I think one of the use cases of ESCO is career guidance. And that's what we're doing. So without it, you know, we would lack a large resource and a common resource, which is at a European level. So I'll leave it there and then others can contribute.
Well, but that's a perfect setup for the question I wanted to put on Kathy's table. And one of the reasons that I invited her here today, Kathy is treasured by all of the colleagues who know her in part because of her unparalleled networking skills, her ability to bring different groups of people together to find common purpose and to create new kinds of partnerships. And Kathy, as our distinguished European colleagues are grappling with the issues that you know so well and that you focused on so long, I wonder if you have any advice for how these efforts might be aligned with the interests of major US employers. The ESCO database, for example, on which they're building, which is the well-respected, well-recognized framework that is often used in Europe to help people identify the skills and competencies that are associated with different professions. And then this current effort is an attempt to build on that to guide people towards a smart catalog of training opportunities that help them. How does that intersect with the interests of major American and multinational employers? And what advice would you have in terms of the area that you're known so well for, among others, of building these kinds of collaborative partnerships that benefit everyone involved?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mitchell, for saying that it's the equivalent of ONET, but ONET, which is the occupational network, which is something we've tried to do for years and have improved on in the US, is not up to date. Given the technology that we have now, there are a number of things that we've tried to steal from Europe over the years. One of them was the national skill standards that we tried to put together with the idea that there needed to be standards in different industries. And we didn't actually get to how those crossed sectors. And that's something that you're building now. So, you know, a lot of learning on both sides, but I appreciate the question. I'm a real believer in making the connections and in showing people, kind of, you know, building as you go, how things work in the field. And so one of the advantages that I've had in the work that I've done is being able to partner with companies that are willing to invest in and try how some of this will work. And you know, what is the this? First of all, It's really important to approach this from the demand side. What you said earlier, Hal, which picks up on the ideas, are employers investing in this because they're finding that traditional education is not preparing people for what they need? And I would add to that, based on what others have said today, also traditional career guidance is not preparing people either for what opportunities there are. So how do we make that more visible? I think it's critical that we, and I think the employers are very interested in bridging the learning and the experience on the job. So again, another thing we've tried to steal from Europe is apprenticeship and really the whole spectrum of work-based learning opportunities. And we find that's where people drop off, is trying to transition from their learning to work. So I think it's really important that these programs have a transitional component where they get experience, they get recognized for their experience. And even in fields that we're working with now, like cybersecurity, there's a lot of really interesting work to be able to start to experiment with that in ways that employers recognize and value and can really help people transition into jobs. And then I guess the last piece of advice I'd say is we need to reevaluate the way we recognize skills and the way we credential them. So we talk a lot about, and you probably do too, what are the alternative credentials? And how do you build in, what's the value of a Google certificate, for example? It's enormous value in terms of market recognition. It, as I said before, is not a threat to a college that integrates that as part of either credit or non-credit programs. And yet it is forcing us to look at how we've hired, trained, skilled people, and what kind of what we're looking for in order to do that.
Thank you. You know, Peter, you mentioned something in your opening remarks that it seems a good time to bring back up right now, and Kathy touched on it briefly as well as did Mitchell, which is the role of artificial intelligence as policymakers are trying to determine what kinds of efforts to fund in skills-based approaches and in job training. And this is a confounding problem. And I'm going to ask you to talk directly to funders now, major funders. I think one of the things that I'm seeing happening because of the rapid developments in artificial intelligence and the chatbots is an almost paralysis on the part of funders, because they have a sense that artificial intelligence is changing the landscape, the technology landscape and the outcome in two ways. One is it's so rapidly changing the labor market that it becomes increasingly difficult to predict what occupations will still exist at the time someone's training is complete. And then the artificial intelligence applications themselves, while displacing the labor market, are also evolving so quickly that every attempt to deploy them in one of these systems can be quickly obsoleted. And that environment creates a paralysis on funders who see everything moving too fast for them to know where to step in. So if you were a major funder at a government level, a minister of education, a foundation head, what advice would you provide about the appropriate place for funders to step in right now to accelerate the success of the work that you've been associated with?
Well, that is a wonderful question. Also very easy to answer. No, just kidding. I think whenever we start to think if something is useful, if it is an investment in time or money, in my mind, it does always make a lot of sense to go to the customer's view. Not going from the meter perspective to an individual, but going asking individuals, what are your problems? What are your challenges? And then taking it from there. So what I would do is see what strong use cases we do have and fund use cases and technology stacks that support to solve specific problems for specific target groups, for example. And even if you're a private investor or a public funder, you would always have to, you would always have the desire to see an outcome that is useful. Right. And I think if you go this way, if you go that line, then you always will find something useful at the end of the road. This is what I would do. And this also makes a lot of sense.
Mitchell, any thoughts if you were Minister of Education with a fat budget and looking to accelerate progress in this field, where would you be looking to make major investments right now?
Well, actually, I think that was Mitchell. Right.
We'll come back to
you. But if you want to add something, Peter, go ahead.
Pass it on. I'm actually in the board in Austria, the digitalization board on ministry level. And one of our major activities right now is just to try to harmonize all activities which are out there, which is kind of a very, very eye-opening event. Even in a small country like Austria, you will see different funding streams that are going into different directions. And what we are trying to do is to harmonize that and pool the efforts which we have. This is something which is a very good first step because you have so many initiatives from micro-credentials to platforms to training of people who want to get into the labor market, et cetera. Harmonizing this field of support and funding is for sure a very important step. And even that step, because you were asking where would I put my money in, even that step needs funding because we need to have a lot of rounds of experts. You need to have people who are really looking into depth of funding and projects and outcomes, etc. So I would do that as a first investment if I would have this big budget.
Yeah, building a council of funders, fascinating. Mitchell, you were about to say.
Well, I mean, I can speak from the EOC perspective because it's also a mission, like the EOC mission of empowering lifelong learners for employability. I think that is where we need to focus. Not that the traditional university model is obsolete. It is not. We definitely need kind of foundational programs, but we also need funding that addresses the need for upskilling, reskilling through personalized learning opportunities, personalized pathways throughout the life. What needs to happen here as well is I think there needs to be more integration between higher ed and industry. We do not have, that has been one of the challenges, not only in just addressing, a university degree today doesn't guarantee a job, nor a master's degree, nor sometimes even a doctoral degree. There are people with doctoral degrees that are unemployed or underemployed. What we do need are mechanisms to understand labor market needs and demands and integrate that into curriculums. I'm not calling for a total human capitalistic model, a human capital model, but there needs to be some influence of what is happening in the labor market and mechanisms for universities to integrate that into curriculum renewal, curriculum design. And then the other piece is career guidance. And as Kathy mentioned, the outdated model of career guidance is not going to work today in the new landscape that we live in. So we need, how can we integrate chatbots, as Peter mentioned? How can we integrate artificial intelligence into career guidance? This is part of support that students need to know. Finally, I think empowering students. I think one of the big pieces is just empowering students to be able to act. Empowering students to action through relevant information, up-to-date information about, the skills landscape in the labor market and where they want to go, which path they want to go, whether it's in a tech field, whether it's in the green economy, which is a huge agenda now in EU and around the world. So yeah, those are some of the pieces I think that are in line with the DReskill project, also in line with the UOC mission, but providing empowering lifelong learners, career guidance has to be part of the piece, connecting lifelong learners with higher education and labor market intelligence is, I think, an important piece, that trifecta.
Yeah. And Kathy, let me and bring a conversation that's taking place in the chat into this conversation, okay. Which is our treasured colleague, Francois Rocher, distinguished professor of chemistry at Sorbonne University, was intrigued by your comments about influencing the curricula and the credentials that colleges themselves offer. We're seeing a very interesting trend in the U.S., which is there's been the development of all of these non-college job trainings, training, employability, employer-sponsored efforts that are separate from the formal higher education system, trying to create an alternative by competing with it outside of the umbrella of higher education. And then there are efforts as well to influence what takes place within higher education so that when those students graduate, they are in fact armed not only with the certificates, but with the skills that our employers are looking for. Do you have any thoughts about which of these two approaches inside the university, Professor Rocher was highlighting in his question, or outside the university, are the preferred approach for the business clients with whom you work?
Right. Well, and what we need, and what I would add to what Mitchell's saying, is that you need the employer commitment, because the programs are only going to be as good as people are, in terms of outcomes, as people are going to be able to get jobs after completing them. So if that is part of the mission of the college, then how do you best prepare your students for the jobs? And a lot of that is done from the demand side. So I think we've seen some very interesting ways, and it's still fledgling, and we're still trying things out. But we now have, I'll give you some specific examples. Google has a suite now of 6 or 8 certificates in IT. And that prepare people for specific jobs that are in demand. And we work with 120 some community colleges that have fully integrated those certificates as part of their offerings. Sometimes it's through their non-credit offerings, and often it's part of their credit offerings, and it's something that can be embedded in and supplement what's already going on in the college. We have companies like Amazon that are investing. So we've said, we've talked about skilling. They're talking about outskilling employees, because there's only so far you can go in Amazon or that kind of a company. And how do they work with colleges and universities to show people where they can go from there? We've got companies, Ubiquitous is a company throughout Europe, where we're looking at what skills people really learn as frontline workers that become a stepping stone then to the college, can be recognized for some immediate small amount of college credit, and then put people on a career path to a better job, to a quality job. So it's new, but it is scalable. And I think it's the future. And as I said, it's going to depend on the employer commitment to recognizing these skills, to hiring these people, are changing, looking at skills as a measurement, and looking at credentials that acknowledge those skills.
So let me turn again back to Peter then. Peter, you were speaking earlier. I've got another easy question for you. I hope, anyway. And of course, I'm being sarcastic too, because it's really a core question. As we look at the goals of the De-Reskill at University project, we call this a multiplier event for the De-Reskill at University project, because one of the goals of the De-Reskill project, as identified by its creators, is to sustain this effort after the two-year support from the initial two-year period of support from Erasmus expires, and to widen its impact, including within Europe and across borders. And you put your finger on a key challenge that we're moving towards, which is, as a developer of the ESCO database, you recognize the fact that you need to now build on it to create real-time exchanges of information between employers and the database so that systems that are built on it are responding, so that, because 6 months can be an eternity, particularly in certain businesses where the skill sets change. And we see employers on some occasions retraining employees, or the employees retraining themselves because of their own ambitions. And just as often we see employers dismissing entire groups of employees and then hiring new groups who may have the more current skills. I wonder if you have any thoughts about this issue of how you facilitate, how you advance this idea of a more real-time exchange of information between these employability systems on a smartphone, a smart catalog, for example, as the DeReskill project is envisioning, and the real labor market needs that Kathy was emphasizing. How can we promote the kind of continuous improvement in these systems which keeps them valid and useful? What's the research we need to do? What are the steps we need to take to move towards more real-time systems?
Okay, thank you for that question. My first thought on this is when we developed ESCO, we were certainly aware that several European states already had their catalogs and their standards. So that was not, it was quite an, I would say, a patchwork of standards. And the first step was to harmonize by law the European states to use that catalog or even implement that catalog. So I think on a specific level, you need some regulations in order to make things happen, because all these catalogs have an old history and a very important history to different states and cultures. So I think regulations is one answer. The second thing is for sure, if you make these catalogs, for example, as accessible as possible, and for sure open source and without having any IPs on that, so that also private agencies can make use of them, then you have an easier access to the information out there, which can also be used by then Google or artificial intelligence. So that regulations, no IPRs, making these standards as open as possible and as easy accessible for people who are even making business in the labor market, right? Mm-hmm. So public agencies, you can more or less advise them to use catalogs, but make it as easy as possible for Monster, LinkedIn, and name it. That is also something which brings us transparency into the labor market, which I was talking. Another thought is that our mission when we started to work on these catalogs was not only to support global players, but mainly to support small and medium enterprises, which are not having their own curricula, which are only hiring from time to time, which don't have too much experience in that, either in addressing skills, nor naming it, nor making job advertisements attractive. They're just kind of beginners in this market. And I think it is very important, if you want to have a strong impact, is think about the use cases in the labor market of small and medium enterprises, which are in Europe more or less 90% employers. So you're talking about small companies with a huge impact. And I think that is sometimes forgotten. I think the global players are very familiar. On my way to San Francisco and Palo Alto, by the way, next week, I'm quite familiar with the global players and their curricula and their standards, but they are global players. They can put out their own standards if they wish, because they have huge access to schools, universities at their fingertips if they want to. I think small and medium enterprises are the right ones to be addressed.
Yeah, well, and you know, speaking from somebody here in Palo Alto, those global players who you'll come visit, and they're all shedding employees now, and many of those employees are now looking to the smaller and medium-sized companies for new opportunities. Mitchell, I think you have some thoughts on this issue of the real-timeization of these systems. How can we structure our work in this area so that it lends itself to the kinds of real-time impact and is as the flexibility that's required to mirror the labor markets as they exist?
Well, I can talk about my current role. I work in a unit that is called Unit for Prospection and Labor Market Analysis. And we're a cross-functional team. We have data scientists, we have economists. I'm a social scientist. I come from educational technology field. But we're working together to try to create mechanisms for understanding, for using labor market intelligence, for example, creating reports for each faculty, the faculty of education sciences and psychology, the faculty of telecommunications and engineering, about the demands in the labor market and what skills are being demanded from job posts in Spain, for example. So this is work we're doing right now. This can help faculty program directors, for example, with curriculum renewal, with program design. We don't obviously want to have it. We want to also create transversal skills in there. We don't want it just to be this human capital model of these are the skills you need to know, but also transversal skills like critical thinking, problem solving, leadership, teamwork, collaboration, et cetera. I mean, that has to be a part of it as well. But this is a piece that USC is really committing to. We've created the standalone unit that is going to be used transversally across the university system, also with a career guidance focus as well. To go with DREES skill, we're also at the USC creating in parallel a similar tool for career guidance called GPS, which is linking labor market intelligence with course offerings, programs offerings, micro-credentials through our university. So I think this is an area which is not common. Many universities don't have ways to integrate labor market intelligence into curriculum, into educational development. It is happening in Europe. You do see a lot of Erasmus level projects being more integrated, but it is not a common practice. And I think needs to be part of higher ed systems.
Colleagues, we have just a few minutes left. We need to end on time today because of commitments that several of us have. But I wanted to turn very quickly to an area that those of you know me won't surprise anyone, which is the role of assessments in all of this. How do we reliably assess a learner outcomes in the use of these kinds of platforms? As some of you know, I've been working for a long time to promote the idea of multi-institutional collaborations to develop simulated assessments, like the simulators that are used to train cybersecurity experts or pilots in the military. And I wonder, just very quickly, we only have maybe a minute and a half each. Do you see roles, potential opportunities to sustain and extend this work through a focus on simulated assessments that could more reliably measure student learning outcomes? Kathy, let me start with you.
Absolutely. And I think I mentioned before, we're experimenting with that in fields like cybersecurity. I think the opportunity to demonstrate skills is going to be really important. And it's something, frankly, that should begin before the university. So we partner, for example, with some of the high school programs that are focused on skills, skills-based learning, and how those transition. So I think more and more we're going to need to recognize the value of a program like pre-apprenticeship or apprenticeship that brings people in and is part of the assessment. I think mentoring is going to be a key part of assessment. I think the idea of, I think a resume and a transcript are both outdated. We're talking about some kind of skills wallet or something where you can acquire a variety of kinds of skills and demonstrate how you have them and how they get validated. So all that's got to evolve at the same time that we're talking about evolving everything else.
Right. Mitchell, we'll turn to you, and then to Pete, we'll give Peter the final word.
I certainly think assessment needs to evolve and innovate. Traditional forms of exam-based assessment and, rote memory and repetition need to evolve. Competency-based assessments and, from a UOC perspective, virtual online learning simulations. It sounds like, I don't have much experience in that regard, but I would say that sounds like an innovation. It sounds like progress in terms of assessment. In terms of credentialing, very quickly, I mean, I think that's also essential. Digital credentialing, the paper model that we have is a certificate, and of these are my grades, this is my certificate. That needs to completely be reformed and evolve. I'm here at MIT and they have a digital credentials consortium trying to create open standards for digital credentialing, for wallets, for credentials that can also demonstrate competencies that you have learned that are portable, that are trusted, that are recognizable, and that also empower the learner. The learner can own them in a wallet and be able to carry them and say, this is what I've studied and this is what I can demonstrate. These are the competencies that I've been able to demonstrate. So yes, absolutely think that that's the right direction to be moving.
Peter, last word on assessments. Simulations have a role possibly. What are your thoughts about the importance of collaborations in that area?
I think simulations are a wonderful concept. And as you gave me inspiration for my answer was hope. My last step would be trust. I think trust is something which is very, very important if you access students or learners. There is always the danger that all these assessments are built on not trusting our students. So I would say hope was my starting point and trust is my last word.
That's an excellent way to end today's conversation. Let me very, very quickly thank again our distinguished panelists today, Kathy Manis, Mitchell Peters, and Peter Mirsky. I also want to thank the steering committee of the D-Reskill at University project for giving me the honor of serving as the interlocutor of today's conversation. And in particular, I would like to thank Professor Corinne Aubert at Sorbonne University and her colleague, Professor Francois Rocher, for their leadership in envisioning this project and in organizing the collaborating universities to participate in it. And then finally, let me thank Foundation Maison de Sciences de l'Homme and our treasured colleague there, Alexandra Dupere, for all of her work in organizing today's conversation and discussion. Thank you very much for your attention and participation today. And as promised, we will end right on time. I look forward to seeing this archive conversation made available to others in the weeks and months and years ahead. Thank you all, and to all a good day, good evening, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Grazie, François.
Bye-bye.
Ricevuto. Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye-bye.